foreign policy post 9/11. It's complicated. Today, Thursday, September 11th. This is The World. America reflects on the events of 13 years ago while also looking ahead to a new U.S. military offensive against Islamic militants in Syria. But the Syrian government doesn't want to talk. And as for the rebels...
Who are the Syrian opposition now? Where are they? So we have two sides. One side that doesn't want to sit down to the table and another side that doesn't exist.
Plus, a story of an Afghan interpreter who went to work for American troops.
The Taliban found out that I was working with Americans and helping them. And they came into my dad and they took him.
Also, we posed some tough questions about the post-9/11 world to former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Plus, good news, finally, about the ozone layer.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It still does not feel as if enough time has passed to make this just another September day. I still wake up, as I have every September 11th since, and look at the sky to see if it comes close to that brilliant blue on that morning. But what is different about this 9/11 anniversary is that the United States has committed to a new war. Just last night, in fact, President Obama outlined his plans to degrade and destroy the militants who call themselves the Islamic State. Obama made clear that means attacking them with airstrikes in Syria as well as in Iraq. Janine DiGiovanni is Middle East editor at Newsweek. I mean, the mention of Syria, Janine, came almost as a footnote to his statement that airstrikes will continue, but can everything he outlined be done and in a neat fashion without boots on the ground?
Well, I think what he said was pretty much what we expected he would say. He's broadening the operation beyond Iraq, but it will need to be followed by ground troops for it to be effective. In most cases with airstrikes, with strategic airstrikes like this, you do need to follow it up with some ground troops.
So I think the challenges for the strategy are pretty clear in Iraq, but the challenges in Syria seem much larger. I mean, Obama seems to be putting his faith in the Free Syrian Army, but how can they help? I mean, do we even know who they are anymore?
Well, this is the real, real difficult question. I mean, there is a theory going around that in many ways this ISIS crisis has, you know, with every crisis you have, there's always an opportunity. And in many ways, look at it this way. The West is getting an opportunity to soften up Iran. Maliki has been removed with the help of Iran, and Assad is probably going to be given a choice of, you know, this is now, you've got to move closer to the negotiating table. The only problem with that is that with Assad, they don't want to, nor are they ready to negotiate. And on the other side, you have, what other side? Who are the Syrian opposition now? Where are they? I, as a reporter that follows this, I have an incredibly difficult time trying to track these guys. Where are they? So we have two sides, one side that doesn't want to sit down to the table and another side that doesn't exist. So this is really the dilemma that Obama's doctrine is going to have now in Syria.
Janine, finally, we spoke with you the day the news came out that Stephen Sotloff had been murdered by ISIS. I mean, that act, many believe, led to Obama's speech last night. You were a friend and colleague of Stephen's. What is your personal reaction to the president's speech, committing the U.S. to war with ISIS?
I find it very ironic that, you know, two freelance journalists who worked so hard would probably find it extraordinary if they are watching this or seeing this in some way that their names are being mentioned by the president's speech and that a doctrine is basically being set out following their murders. But on the other hand, it makes me slightly angry to think that it had to get to this stage, that they've been allowed to get to this kind of level before the world's attention is taking notice of this. To me, this seems awfully late. As far as 2 years ago, as journalists on the ground, we were hearing about ISIS. We were hearing about these guys. I find it very hard to believe that security officials in America didn't pay more attention to it and let it get to the stage where they beheaded two young, talented American journalists.
Are you worried that more airstrikes are going to cause more killings of captured Americans and Britons? And we're not even talking about those 49 Turks who are being held.
I don't know. On the other hand, in Bosnia, airstrikes were very welcome because it was what was needed, strategic airstrikes, to break down the Serbs' resistance. So there's always a price to be paid for airstrikes. And, of course, the other thing is the collateral damage on the ground of getting it wrong, hitting civilians. But I think that the time has come. What other choice do we have right now?
Janine DiGiovanni, Middle East editor at Newsweek and author of Ghosts by Daylight, a memoir of war and love. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
President Obama last night said the campaign against ISIS is going to be very different from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. As he said before, it won't rely on lots of new boots on the ground, but rather on American air power.
The strategy of taking out terrorists who threaten us while supporting partners on the front lines is one that we have successfully pursued in Yemen and Somalia for years.
So just how well are things working out in Yemen and Somalia? William McCants is a counterterrorism expert at the Brookings Institution. Why do you think Obama held up Yemen and Somalia as examples of what the U.S. campaign against ISIS in Iraq and possibly Syria are going to look like?
Because that's the model that the United States has shifted to after a decade of having boots on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. The administration feels that this lighter footprint approach is more appropriate in an age when the American public has less of an appetite for occupying foreign countries. It comes with some significant downsides, though. One, not having boots on the ground means you have to rely on proxy forces to do your bidding. And two, focusing solely on air power to carry out attacks means that you don't always have control over where the munitions land, and you can end up killing civilians as a result.
So what exactly is the U.S. doing in Yemen and Somalia today?
In Yemen, it's been working with the Yemeni government to train and equip its forces to go after al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the al-Qaeda affiliate there. It's also been reportedly using drone strikes and strikes from ships off the coast to hit al-Qaeda targets in that country. In Somalia, there's not really, or not until recently, there hasn't been a government there for the United States to work with. So we have been working with African forces from neighboring countries to go after the Shabaab, which is another al-Qaeda affiliate that operates in the country. And we've carried out attacks from the air and reportedly one or two attacks from the ground as well using special forces. But both of these approaches in Yemen and Somalia are similar in that they have a very light footprint and the environment is more permissive for U.S. airstrikes. That's very different from what the U.S. government is contemplating inside of Syria, where we have a president, Bashar al-Assad, who's very much against American Air Force being deployed in his country to go after Islamic State militants.
Yeah, I want you to talk about some of those differences in a second. But first, I mean, Yemen and Somalia and U.S. counterterror strategy in these places, would you describe it as a success story?
These were weak states to begin with, and there's not a lot that the United States can do, particularly since it has gotten out of the state-building game after a long and frustrating experience in Afghanistan and Iraq. So it's doing its best to ensure that there is some government that it can work with, but this is primarily a counterterrorism focus for the administration, and that focus has produced qualified successes, namely no major attacks on the United States homeland originating from either of those countries.
So break down how Syria and Iraq are different from Yemen and Somalia in terms of how an American-supported counterterrorism strategy would work.
Yeah, the geography is different. Yemen and Somalia are really on the periphery of the Arab world. Iraq and Syria are in its heartland and are neighbors of some major allies of ours. Iraq is somewhat similar in that we have a permissive government there that is willing to sanction U.S. strikes and a limited force on the ground. Syria is quite different. The President Bashar al-Assad does not want American forces, even just air power, penetrating his country unless we are explicitly working there with his permission, which President Obama will not seek.
William McCants of the Brookings Institution speaking with us from Washington. Thank you.
Thank you.
Another nation where the U.S. conducted airstrikes not so long ago is Libya, although it was only in the context of NATO helping Libyan rebels to topple dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Since that revolution, Libya has been engulfed in chaos as different armed militias battle for power. Radical militants are also a threat in the country, as Americans discovered when militants attacked U.S. diplomatic facilities in Benghazi, killing U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. That was 2 years ago today. Marine Olivesi is in Tobruk, Libya. And just to start off with, Marine, tell us where you are physically in Tobruk.
So I'm right now on the deck of a Greek ferry boat that's been docked in the port of Tobruk, and it's been turned into some kind of floating hotel. Tobruk is where Libya's new parliament is meeting, and the reason why they're convening here in a city that's actually very close to the Egyptian border but very removed from the capital, Tripoli, is that the House of Representatives was elected late June of this year. They only convened after Ramadan, so at the end of July, and by then Tripoli was a war zone. So the representatives decided to move to Tobruk, which is probably one of the safest towns under control still of the army, a militia-free area. The problem is Tobruk wasn't really prepared to receive such an influx of representatives along with their families and entourage. So the House of Representatives asked a Greek company to send one of its boats to the rescue. But don't imagine anything too fancy, though. It's more of a ferry boat than a proper cruise ship. But it isn't meant for passengers to stay on and on.
Yeah, that should give our listeners a pretty good sense of how messy things are in Libya right now. With that in mind, we've heard President Obama speak about his plans to combat the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. What are people in Libya saying about the president's speech? Are they wondering if and how Libya might fit into all this?
Well, there have been so many problems in Libya lately that there hasn't been really any reaction yet. But what we can say is that people still remember today as the very somber anniversary of Chris Stevens' killing and the Benghazi attack. And what they're telling me for sure is that right after the Benghazi attack, you certainly had a lot of people here pushing for some kind of intervention back then. People really thought that the Obama administration would try to take down the extremist militants in Benghazi, specifically the extremist group Ansar al-Sharia that's believed to be responsible for the attack. So people were gearing for an offensive, but it never actually came. And I spoke yesterday with Amal Bayou, a parliament member from Benghazi. Here's what she had to say.
At that time, we are all shocked and surprised at what's happened. Really, I'm sometimes upset because the war did not help us to finish this terrorism. You know, the problem that in Quran they say, if you kill one person, that's like if you kill all the people on the world. If they have the authority to kill one, so they have no problem to kill all.
So it's a dire situation in Libya. Let me just go back to that question I asked you earlier. Are you getting a sense from Libyans that they'd like some help from the West to kind of bring some peace to their country?
The sense that I'm getting now is that you're having two different kind of problems. They're the radical militants in eastern Libya, in the city of Derna and Benghazi. And many Libyans believe that the only way to go would be to continue the military offensive against them. But then over the summer, you had another problem emerging, which is that the very same militias that had together fought against Muammar Gaddafi turned their weapons on each other. And it's been creating another kind of problem that's more of a fight for power and who's controlling the capital. And when it comes to settling that problem between rival militias, several representatives told us that the only way to go would be to have the international community really forcing both sides to sit together and sort out the issues. And that's really the problem here. You have representatives who are in Tobruk, who are trying to figure out how they could extend their grasp on the country, but they do realize that their power doesn't extend much beyond the city.
Reporter Marine Olivesi aboard the Greek car ferry, which now houses Libya's parliament. Marine, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Still ahead on the world, getting inside the ISIS propaganda machine on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from Lookout, working to protect people and enterprises from mobile threats with 50 million users worldwide. More information at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. not guilty of murder. That was the pronouncement today from the judge in the trial of South African athlete Oscar Pistorius, which is not to say the judge has totally cleared the double amputee track star. Pistorius does not deny that he shot and killed his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, last year, but he does claim it was a mistake because he thought he was shooting an intruder, and he could still be found guilty of a lesser homicide charge. Geoffrey York is in Pretoria covering the trial for Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper. Geoffrey, this judge, Judge Masipa, took hours to read and explain parts of her judgment today. Summarize for us the main reasons she gave for her partial not guilty verdict.
Well, on the murder question, I mean, you have to divide it into two parts. The most difficult to prove always was going to be the issue of premeditated murder, which was, the idea that Oscar and Reva had an argument that night. There was some screaming. Oscar deliberately picked up his gun and decided to shoot his girlfriend. That was always going to be very difficult to prove. And that depended on testimony from the neighbors and so on and so on. And the judge very quickly dispensed with that charge. She just said that the evidence from the neighbors was too contradictory. They were too far away. They really weren't sure what they heard. And it was contradicted even by the timeline of the phone records. So she dispensed with that. The key question was whether he would be found guilty of shooting whoever it was behind the door, not necessarily his girlfriend, but just an intruder or whoever it was. The fact that he fired four shots into a small enclosed space indicated to a lot of people that he was trying to kill whoever it was behind that door. And that was what was controversial today in her verdict. She said, no, the prosecution did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Oscar Pistorius intended to kill whoever it was behind the door.
She was, I gather from some reports, pretty critical of Pistorius as a witness, right?
Yes, that's true. And that's one reason for the kind of the reaction that we're getting in South Africa now. A lot of people quite disturbed by this acquittal on murder, because everybody saw Pistorius on the witness stand and they saw, you know, what the judge herself said today, which was that he was evasive, he was a poor witness, he was untruthful on some points, he was argumentative and debating and so on and so on. You know, he came off as either quite arrogant or sorry for himself, or, you know, people saw that and they didn't have a high opinion of him after that. And, so people were surprised that he'd be found not guilty of murder. But those are really two separate questions. Just because, you know, the judge correctly pointed out that just because somebody looks bad on the witness stand and may not be answering truthfully on all questions, that it doesn't inherently prove that that person is guilty.
And just as an aside, the verdict came from the judge and not a jury. This was not a jury trial, was it?
That's right. South Africa got rid of their jury system back, I think, in 1969 under the apartheid system. So it was purely the judge with the assistance of two non-judges, two so-called assessors who were providing advice to her and even, I think, weighing in on the decision. But basically, it was her decision, yes.
So this is not the end, as we said, for Pistorius. Back in court tomorrow. What happens then?
Well, yeah, I mean, the judge seemed to be leading quite clearly. I mean, we don't know for sure, but it did seem that she was leading towards a verdict of guilty on culpable homicide. And, you know, even though some people are outraged that Oscar Pistorius was acquitted of murder, the judge does have the power to impose quite a heavy prison sentence on Pistorius if she finds he is guilty of culpable homicide. She could easily impose a 10 or 12 year sentence on him. There's also three other firearms charges, lesser firearms charges in connection with separate incidents that the judge will have to rule on tomorrow as well.
In so many ways, Geoffrey, I know our American listeners will feel this. There's an O.J. Simpson quality to Oscar Pistorius and his story, a legendary sports figure charged with murder, and the issue of race floats uneasily through the whole narrative. What are some of the issues that the Pistorius trial brought up outside the courtroom?
Well, there's sort of an issue of race, although, you know, keep in mind that in some ways this trial was an example of how far forward South Africa has moved in 20 years since apartheid, because, you know, we have a judge who grew up in poverty in Soweto Township and, you know, fought her way up from really a difficult background, now is sitting in judgment over a very wealthy, you know, powerful celebrity white athlete. So, you know, in some ways, it's a story of the transformation of South Africa. On the other hand, there's also the sort of subtext that it's reasonable, perhaps, to be worried about crime in South Africa. And so, therefore, You know, there's an argument that it was normal for Oscar Pistorius to pick up a gun and assume that he was being invaded by somebody. On the other hand, the judge was very strong today in pointing out that it's not really normal to have a gun under your bed. In fact, millions of South Africans do not have guns under their bed. And, you know, the sort of notion that South Africa has a gun culture. In fact, the rate of gun ownership in South Africa is much lower than it is in the U.S. It has some social implications, but it probably would be unfair to say that this case simply revolves around South Africa being a crime-ridden society or a racial society or something like that. It's a lot more complicated than that.
And public reaction to the verdict, did it kind of fall along racial lines or wasn't even kind of identified?
No, I don't think it did. I don't think it did. It fell along the lines of a lot of people assuming that he should be found guilty of something. And, you know, because it's a two-day verdict, I mean, because she was reading the verdict and going through everything, we haven't seen the final outcome, and we don't know the sentencing either. So, you know, it's easy for some people today maybe to get outraged saying, oh, he's been, you know, he's, as a lot of people said on Twitter, you know, he's getting away with murder. But in fact, you know, tomorrow, if he's found guilty of culpable homicide, and then in a few weeks, if he's given a very, you know, a pretty substantial prison sentence or even some time in jail, he hasn't got away with it. So, you know, the reaction so far is, I think, because people were very negative about Oscar Pistorius, most people, I think, after they saw him on the witness stand. And so a lot of people want to see him get punished. And they were disturbed that he was acquitted on the murder charge. But, you know, we have to wait until tomorrow and see what else happens.
Jeffrey York, the Africa correspondent for Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Sure, no problem.
Before we take a break, a quick note about a story we've got coming up in the second half of the program. Journalist Peter Moss has spent more than a decade covering America's post-9/11 wars. He's seen some horrible things, and he thinks more Americans should see them too.
You know, these are horrendous images that I wish I didn't have to see, that I wish I hadn't seen, that I wish didn't even occur, that could not be seen, but they are occurring. And they are, in my mind, essential reasons for which war has to be considered very, very deeply before getting into it and before deciding to stay in it.
More of my conversation with Peter Moss. That's ahead on The World. News headlines are next here on The World from PRI. I'm Marco Werman. The militants known as the Islamic State use brutal tactics to get their point across, but also some slick videos.
It's surprising how contemporary and hip-looking some of these things are, considering the fact that the messages that they are promoting are essentially medieval.
Behind the militant propaganda machine, coming up on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 13 years since those hijackers commandeered four planes, two of them out of our city, Boston, and so many things changed. You could say that the world order shifted on this day back in 2001, or perhaps it was a long-established world order that simply got magnified by the 9/11 attacks, and suddenly we saw it for what it really was. Henry Kissinger has a new book out called World Order. Kissinger, of course, served under Presidents Nixon and Ford as National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. Today, he described for me his first impressions when he saw the Twin Towers come tumbling down.
It was obviously unexpected, shattering. The world order was not super stable then, but not so apparently unstable as it later became.
The response by the Bush administration to go into Iraq after 9/11, a rush past diplomacy, a concocted reason for war, WMD, and then a quagmire until 2008.
Well, I don't believe it was concocted. I believe, and I think I know, that they sincerely believed that there were nuclear weapons there, because I talked to these individuals during the crisis. And moreover, people forget that in 1998, in the end of the Clinton administration, the Senate, by a vote of 98-0, voted that it should be our policy to overthrow Saddam and Clinton signed that. So this was not just a concoction of one administration.
You supported the invasion of Iraq. Do you regret that support?
If I had known everything then that I know now, I probably would not have supported it. I thought it would be a quick operation to replace Saddam. I did not think it would lead to, and I would not have favored, a long-term occupation in order to reconstruct the society and to try to repeat the experiences of Germany and Japan in a country that had no comparable institutions. I even then thought that it was beyond the capacity of the United States, or maybe anybody, to turn Iraq into a Western-style democracy.
If that was the stated goal, then how could you support it?
Originally, the stated goal was more related to security. But I really didn't come on this program to go over the Iraq war. It happened that sincere people made important decisions that had consequences they didn't foresee.
What would you say, then, is a lesson for world order from 9/11, not just Iraq, but also the long war in Afghanistan as well?
The United States has been engaged in 5 wars since World War II. In only one of them did it reach its stated objective. In another one, it ended in a stalemate, and from 3 others, we withdrew unilaterally. I'm talking about the first Iraq war in which we achieved our objectives, the Korean War, which ended up as a kind of a stalemate, and Vietnam, the second Iraq war, and Afghanistan, from which we withdrew unilaterally.
Your chapter on Islam is pretty interesting, and given the complexities of Muslim history that you outline, it seems like it's going to take serious leadership to negotiate the tensions roiling the Arab world right now. We've got both al-Qaeda and ISIS who believe in the establishment of a caliphate, and whether that's widely supported by the world's Muslims or not, the concept seems to have some kind of visceral appeal for some people. What do you make of the American
response? Well, it's also one aspect of what has already happened in Islamic history. They've had caliphates.
That's very seductive, that history. I'm just curious to what you make of the American response to ideological extremism in the wake of 9/11. Why do you think it seems to have been so unsuccessful?
Well, because the United States generally believes that, and it's based on its history, that order is the natural relationship. And when order is disturbed, it is a specific reason, and when you remove that cause of the disturbance, that order and peace will reassert themselves. In fact, in almost every part of the world, order is a dynamic process. It can never be equated strictly with a status quo that can then be frozen in place. So for America, the discovery of being in a world that is a process rather than a series of specific conditions. And the second discovery, that while America is essential to the solution of problems, it alone cannot solve all of them, or many of them. So those were two upsetting, maybe shattering experiences of the Vietnam and Iraq and Afghan war, which have then in turn divided the American opinion in such a way that it is very difficult to distill a consistent sense of direction. That's what I want to call attention to.
Last night we heard President Obama allude to American exceptionalism again, and yet he also spoke of what you just said, that need for building coalitions. I mean, this plan to combat ISIS, do you think it's going to work?
Well, ISIS is a group of 20,000 fanatics. For the purely military side of it, a coalition isn't really all that important. But one has to bring about participation of significant part of the Sunni world in order to prevent other variations of it from reappearing. And in that sense, a coalition is of some consequence.
I'm just curious, do you think nuclear weapons will ever be used in the Mideast, say in the next 5 to 10 years?
In my personal experience, the one issue that haunted me most was what would happen if we reached a point where one considered the use of nuclear weapons? Because I think the consequences for the world might be at least as irreversible as World War I was, and probably more so. I would fear that if nuclear weapons spread more widely, that then they may be triggered. And there may also be groups that believe that this is a kind of salvation. I do not think a nuclear war between the existing nuclear countries, it's probable in the next 5 years. if the existing nuclear countries double, then the risk becomes much greater.
By the way, I tried to ask Henry Kissinger about what happened in Chile 41 years ago today on September 11th, 1973. That's when the country's military staged a coup to overthrow Chile's democratically elected president, Salvador Allende. We wanted to ask Kissinger to clarify what his role was at the time. He and the Nixon administration supported the brutal military junta that took power, led by General Augusto Pinochet. But when I raise the subject today, Kissinger cut me off. Let me actually ask you about, we started talking about 9/11, speaking of decisions. There's another 9/11 that people in Chile will recall as
No. You are not going to go through the left-wing debates of 50 years ago.
Well, I think it's a relevant question considering it's 9/11.
I've adequately discussed those, and you can ask me to do them in another forum.
But I
know what you're going to ask. And you're going to try to implicate the United States, and I'm going you pick another subject or we end this program.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, his new book is called World Order. There's been a lot of media coverage of the Islamic State's propaganda videos, and it's largely focused on two of them, the gruesome ones in which two American journalists were beheaded. But the extremist group has put out many other videos, and lately they seem to be showing more skill in their production. Bruce Wallace went to get an expert opinion on that.
To the untrained eye, my eye specifically, there are some recent videos from ISIS's propaganda machine that seem eerily well made. But I wanted to get some trained eyes on them.
It makes a water sound and a very bass sound, which is two different sound layers.
Elliot Greenbaum is a filmmaker in New York. He's made corporate and political ads in feature films. The ISIS video we're watching starts with a clean animated logo emerging as these sound layers play underneath.
Not super technically hard, but also a pain, and something that an amateur wouldn't know would help make things feel more robust.
The 2.5-minute video draws on the language of a rock or skateboard video, Greenbaum says. English language translations of the lyrics, talk of rallying soldiers and establishing the Islamic State, flash across the screen. In the background, digitally tweaked black and white photos of ISIS fighters marching, brandishing guns, and piled in the back of pickup trucks, shake back and forth with barely contained energy.
Then there's just a ton of work that went into this particular video where they're taking archival photographs and they're adding filters to them and they're layering the photos so that they look fragmented and highly active, and it's techniques that a Madison Avenue firm would try to deploy on behalf of a client.
He guesses it took 3 or 4 days of post-production work, animating and adding filters and sounds. And the skills involved in that work aren't ones you can learn in a couple hours.
The way that it's choreographed together suggests someone who's probably had a job doing this sort of thing somewhere in a city with a film production economy.
The video is one of several that have appeared in the past few months. There are also what the Islamic State calls Muja tweets, one-minute easily shareable snippets showing jihadists playing with kids or shopkeepers glorifying life under Islamic State rule. It's all the work of a new ISIS propaganda branch called Al-Hayat Media. The videos are notable for their style, and for the audience they're apparently aimed at, Westerners. The videos are translated into English in a bunch of European languages. A few of them feature English-speaking fighters. Bill Raggio edits the Long War Journal. He says that not only are these videos more sophisticated than those from other jihadist groups, there are just more of them, and they come out faster.
Al-Qaeda will issue a propaganda statement once every month. With the Islamic State, I saw the aftermath of the Battle of Tabqa that gave them full control of a province in Syria. I saw that video 2 days after the battle. Really stunning stuff when you think about it, the messaging that they're getting across there. It's the immediacy of the information.
It's actually surprising how contemporary and hip-looking some of these things are, especially considering the fact that the messages that they are promoting are essentially medieval.
Sean Houston is a professor of English and film studies at the Citadel, a military college, who's written about extremist video propaganda. We were talking about another one of the ISIS videos, this one jammed with violent, graphic scenes of killing, doused in a bunch of those effects Elliot Greenbaum mentioned.
we've got the aesthetic influence of action movies, adventure movies, thriller movies, and even video games. You don't have any kind of focus on the human suffering involved in death. You don't have any kind of emphasis on the fact that these victims are human beings who have family members and other people who love them.
Elliot Greenbaum agreed about the video's desensitizing effects. He says that while the bells and whistles show off technical skill, they likely don't accomplish ISIS's main goal.
It may not matter that the jihadists are throwing the kitchen sink at this media, because it could be that rock videos don't actually get that many people to join up.
One effect the videos have had, says the Long War Journal's Bill Raggio, Western media sure is paying attention. For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace.
As you heard in Bruce's report, ISIS is deploying slick media production techniques for its propaganda. They're disturbing and troubling, but they may give you a better understanding of what's happening in Syria and Iraq. So we've posted a few examples of those ISIS videos online. They're at PRI.org. Okay, this might be a first for us. Two pieces of good news on the environment in just 1 week. A few days ago, we heard how the population of blue whales in the eastern Pacific has bounced back to about where it was before whaling. And today we hear this. The ozone layer is also bouncing back. The World's Environment Editor, Peter Thompson, is here with me now. So can you take this much good news, Peter? I mean, is it like throwing you off your game?
My game's already off this week, Mark. My daughter just started kindergarten, and she is loving it. So that's kind of like got me on cloud nine already. And now with this news, I kind of feel like this cloud of anxiety and depression that usually follows me around is suddenly lifted. I'm not sure I really recognize myself this week.
Okay, so what is the news on ozone specifically?
Well, it's interesting because this is a problem that's kind of fallen out of the news for years, and that's because we actually figured out a solution to it a long time ago. Back in the 70s, a couple of scientists discovered that some very common chemicals, mostly things that are used in refrigeration and air conditioning, were escaping into the atmosphere and destroying the Earth's ozone layer. Now, ozone is a special kind of oxygen. It filters out a lot of the sun's ultraviolet rays that can otherwise basically bust up DNA and cause things like skin cancer. So these scientists realized those chemicals could destroy ozone. Before long, we started seeing evidence that it was actually happening. And within barely 10 years, the world struck an agreement to phase those chemicals out. It was called the Montreal Protocol. It went into effect in 1989. So the news is now, 25 years later, ozone levels have finally stopped falling. And in some parts of the atmosphere, they've actually started increasing. And that comes from a new report from the UN and the World Meteorological Organization.
So 25 years, is that a long time or a short time for the ozone to bounce back?
Well, all these chemicals we've been putting in the atmosphere take a long time to break down. And the ozone takes a while to build back up again. It's a long, slow process, but perhaps by mid-century, it'll be roughly back to where it was.
So we're not totally out of the woods on this.
Well, no, like I said, it'll be several more decades before it's back to where it was. And there's still a problem. There's new chemicals that are affecting it some. It's actually kind of bound up also with a climate change problem. So, no, we're not out of the woods. But the bottom line is that this is a real global environmental success story. And one of the big ironies in all this is that early on in that process, industry said the science is uncertain and it would cost too much to replace these chemicals.
Right. Echoes of the debate over climate change. I mean, without the big fix.
Well, yeah, the parallels are very direct in a lot of ways. But, of course, climate change really kind of dwarfs the ozone problem. But the lesson is that we can do this. And the new report is really evidence of that.
Do you think it's enough evidence to give us hope?
All I can say really is that it's important to have these kinds of successes, not just in my line of work, but I really think for all of us. You know, the news on the environment is just usually so bad day to day. I think it's really important for folks to be reminded that when we really put our minds to things, we can fix a lot of the environmental problems that we've created for ourselves. And this is a great example of that and really a moment to take heart.
All right. Good news from the Environment Desk, the World's Environment Editor, Peter Thompson. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Marco.
You're tuned to The World from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Americans are not used to seeing unfiltered images of war. For many years, we couldn't even see pictures of the caskets that held the remains of fallen servicemen and women when they returned home. Just recently, though, we've been swung almost to the opposite extreme after ISIS militants in Syria posted gruesome videos showing the beheading of two American journalists. Nobody could ever be comfortable seeing images like those. But perhaps our shock upon seeing those videos was all the greater because we've been purposely sheltering ourselves from uncomfortable images. Reporter Peter Moss with The Intercept thinks it's important for Americans to see their dead. He remembers coming to that conclusion during the Iraq War when he flew out of Baghdad on a military plane that also carried a dozen caskets.
When the caskets were taken off of the aircraft in Kuwait, there was a very emotional, very strong process with soldiers who marched in perfect order and with white gloves and very respectfully handled these caskets and saluted and took them off the aircraft. And I took pictures of this while this was going on. And the moment that this ceremony was over, everybody on the plane was put onto a bus. And then just as the bus's doors were closing, a military policeman stepped on board and said, somebody was taking pictures. Who was that? And actually, there had been a soldier who was taking pictures, and she raised her hand. And so the MP took her camera and deleted the photos. And then he left, and then he came back on the bus and said, somebody else was taking pictures. And that was me, because I had taken out my camera during this ceremony and taken pictures. And so I raised my hand. He had me. And he took my camera, and he deleted the photos, and then gave the camera back to me. And that frustrated me immensely, because I thought, this wasn't gore, even. This was actually an incredibly dignified, important process of returning the dead to their homes. And we couldn't even take pictures of that. And the censorship wasn't just an abstract policy. It was a military policeman seizing my camera and deleting pictures that I think were important pictures that people should not be deprived of seeing.
Of course, we can see those images now, but Peter Moss says that kind of censorship continues to condition how we react to gruesome images, including those ISIS beheading videos. So I asked Peter Moss, how would he like to see America handle images of its casualties?
These images that we're talking about, images of American dead, of American injured, are terrible images that, you know, I've seen, and I've seen, you know, in front of me as opposed to on a website or on a newspaper. You know, these are horrendous images that I wish I didn't have to see, that I wish I hadn't seen, that I wish didn't even occur, that could not be seen, but they are occurring. And they are, in my mind, essential reasons for which war has to be considered very, very deeply before getting into it and before deciding to stay in it. And I think that if you don't see these things, although the imagination can take you far, although the written word can take you far, I think in many cases, however, actually seeing these things has an effect beyond what the imagination can accomplish, beyond what the written word can accomplish, an effect that makes you A, understand a bit more, and B, perhaps react. Now, I can't, however, say that if people saw these images, we would therefore decide on the right policies and make the right decisions. I can't say that, because photographs, imagery of war, these are things that are uncontrollable when you see them. You don't know what reactions individuals will have. You don't know how governments will try to use them. And I've been in enough war zones and enough conflict areas to see photography, to see war imagery abused, to see governments drum up kind of revenge, hysteria, etc. And so a great amount of abuse can happen. A great amount of blowback can happen when these images are published. But I think that we have to take that chance, because we have to give ourselves the chance to see and to hopefully understand as a result of this imagery. And if we don't even give ourselves that chance, then we won't have the hope, perhaps, of getting there in terms of understanding what is going on, what is happening to our loved ones, and whether or not we should be going in this direction.
Peter Moss with The Intercept, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The images we were discussing there are disturbing, no question, but as we remember the 9/11 attacks today, they're as relevant as ever. If you'd like to see the sort of pictures we've been talking about, we have some examples at PRI.org. Now, one more story about the legacy of 9/11 and the wars that have followed.
My full name is Mohammed Yousafi. From 2008, I started working with the Marines.
Mohammed paid a steep price for serving as an interpreter for U.S. forces in Afghanistan.
The Taliban found out that I was working with Americans and helping them, and they came into my dad and they took him, they tortured him, and they killed him, and they threw him on the water.
Mohammed's family begged him to quit. Eventually, he did and went home to Kandahar, but the Taliban thought he was still working for the Americans.
So what they did, they kidnapped my little brother, and they sent me a ransom letter that I have to pay them $35,000. If I don't pay that, they will kill my little brother and put it next to my dad's grave.
Mohammed paid the ransom, and his brother was released. At that point, Mohammed decided he and his family had to get out of Afghanistan. They moved to Pakistan and went into hiding. And Mohammed asked one of the Marines he worked with, a close friend now, to help him get a U.S. visa. Then he waited, and he waited.
I was waiting for 3 years. Finally, I got my visa. So I got here to the United States on January 21st of 2014. I came in here to San Francisco. I knew that Adrian is waiting for me outside. The Marine captain who I used to work with, he was waiting for me. Not just him, there's a group of people, like 20, 25 people up there. And Adrian was telling me that usually when the military personnel are coming back from deployment and they want to come back to, so like usually their family members or their friends go in to say thanks for their, what they did. So the same, they did the same thing for me. They're still helping me. They're still trying to help my family, trying to bring them over here to the state. So all those people that try to help me, now they're helping my family. Like, I'm here physically, but I'm not here mentally because I'm always thinking about them, about my family.
Mohammed Yousafi, a former interpreter for American forces in Afghanistan, now living here in the U.S. And we leave you today with a final musical note from Afghan musician Qureshi. He's been living in New York City for nearly 30 years. Here's a track from his latest recording, Mountain Melodies, from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. And by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Tagney-Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.